thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's on vacation. The latest FBI statistics conclude that the Hispanic street gang known as MS-13 has expanded to 10,000 members in 42 states and the District of Columbia. Two journalists have written books profiling members of the gang. They joined me in the studio to talk about the evolution of MS-13 and the threat it poses throughout urban, suburban, and rural America. Sarah Garland is the author of Gangs in Garden City. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Samuel Logan, who is author of This Is for the Mara Salvatrucha. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
We're inviting our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. First, we're going to talk with Herb Brown. He is section chief for the Criminal Investigation Division at FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. He joins us by phone. Mr. Brown, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Susan. A pleasure to be on your program.
Tell us, what is the MS-13 gang?
Well, the MS-13 gang was originally started in Los Angeles. It was a loosely affiliated group at that time, but over the years, as we've seen this group, or what are referred to as cliques, become more concentrated, more coordinated in their criminal activity. And unfortunately, as we have seen, they've expanded into areas like Atlanta, Dallas, Washington, D.C., and more recently in areas like Omaha, Nebraska, Denver, Colorado, and Charlotte, North Carolina.
Now, in 2004, the FBI created a special task force for the MS-13. Is that an unusual step for the FBI to take?
It wasn't unusual. At that time, I was actually the special agent in charge in Los Angeles, and we were taking a look at the trends in the migration of MS-13, not only in Los Angeles, but we're seeing at that time a tremendous migration of that gang going into the smaller rural areas of the country, as you mentioned earlier in your program. We felt at that time that you needed a national coordination center, kind of an intelligence-driven command structure that would be able to coordinate and support local, state, as well as national MS-13 and 18th Street gang investigations.
And how big a threat do you think MS-13 poses in terms of drugs and crimes? How big a threat?
Well, if you take a look at our national strategy, we see MS-13 as one of the largest gangs, Hispanic gangs in the country. It's in 42 states. We have seen more recently, as I mentioned, the expansion of criminal activity from MS-13 from Los Angeles to Denver, Omaha, more recently in Charlotte, North Carolina. But just as importantly, as of today, two gang members that were convicted here in Alexandria from the Washington Field Office investigation on the shooting that occurred last October in 2008 in Reston, Virginia. So it doesn't matter if it's Los Angeles or in the smaller rural areas, the expansion has occurred, is occurring, and probably will occur, which is one of the reasons why we have the MS-13 National Gang Task Force.
Are there links between MS-13 and kind of international terrorist groups?
Not that we have seen. The links that we have seen on the national and transnational area have been with some of the cartels in Mexico, but most importantly is the tremendous link that MS-13 has in this country directly with El Salvador and many of the prison gangs in El Salvador.
And the efforts of the FBI and other law enforcement agencies in the past few years, great for us. How successful have they been? Have you found a strategy that really works?
That's a good way to put it, Susan. I mean, the thread that's worked for us, simply put, is a task force environment. The FBI has 152 task forces in 54 cities throughout the country, about 650 agents assigned to those task forces. But the most important perspective of those task forces is that we have about 1,300 state and local police officers assigned to those task forces that concentrate on local, regional, national gangs. And, of course, MS-13 has been one of the biggest gangs we've been focusing on in various cities throughout the country. So it's been a tremendous force multiplier for us utilizing those task forces. And we do the same, actually, in El Salvador as well.
Is MS-13, are the ranks of MS-13 getting bigger or smaller now?
I think it's expanded. If you take a look at our trends and if you take a look at some of the intelligence gaps that we probably have missed over the years, we're seeing more of a focused, coordinated effort by MS-13. More recently, I was down in El Salvador with many of my counterparts, and we've been able to establish, with the assistance of the State Department and the Department of Justice, our Transnational Anti-Gang Initiative, where we actually have agents embedded with PNC or federal officers from El Salvador. Also, we're establishing those tag initiatives in Honduras and Guatemala. And what we've seen, Susan, is a tremendous feedback of prison gang members in El Salvador, MS-13 members, communicating constantly with members in Omaha, Denver, Los Angeles, and more recently in Charlotte, North Carolina.
And what is the end result of this kind of transnational communication? What are they talking to each other about?
They communicate leadership efforts. The leadership in El Salvador will talk to a particular clique in Denver who will coordinate drug operations, let's say, in Los Angeles. And, of course, if you look at the pervasive criminal activity involving MS-13, they're involved in alien smuggling, assaults, drive-by shootings, homicides, identity theft, prostitution operations, as well as weapons trafficking. So the coordinated effort sometimes originates in El Salvador, and the true challenge for us is to make sure we maintain those task force operations with our FBI personnel down in those countries.
You know, there was a time when we thought about organized crime in the FBI, we were thinking about the mafia. Is MS-13 like the mafia, or is it different in some big ways?
I think it's different in many ways, but there are similarities as far as the outcome. The outcome has been a devastation to our communities in the bigger cities, and more recently, as we all have seen, in our smaller rural areas. The structure is different, but the way we attack MS-13 really is no different than the way we attacked the LCN of the 70s and 80s. We take a look at the organizational structure. We use sophisticated undercover operations to take down groups and organizations. That has been the success of these task forces. So in that way, it's similar, but structurally, a little different.
And one last question. When it comes to these gangs, is the Obama administration taking any different approach than the Bush administration took?
No, I think both administrations know the problem. And I mean, one of the last concerns that I have is that I attended a chief meeting in Chicago, and, you know, I had the opportunity to talk to Superintendent Jody Weiss from Chicago PD, Chief Timoney from Miami, Chief Ramsey from Philadelphia, and smaller police department chiefs, in that law enforcement cannot, and I repeat, cannot arrest ourselves out of this gang issue, be it MS-13 or 18th Street or Bloods and Crips. We have to be able to work on the prevention and intervention side. I believe both administrations have focused on that and will continue to focus on the suppression side, which is our responsibility in law enforcement, but also not to forget the intervention and prevention side.
All right. Herb Brown, thank you so much for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you, Susan. A pleasure to be on your program.
Herb Brown is Section Chief for the Criminal Investigation Division at FBI Headquarters here in Washington, D.C. Well, let me go to our guests in the studio, Samuel Logan. He's written a book called This Is for the Mara Salvatrucha. I'm sure I'm not saying that quite right. And Sarah Garland, who's the author of Gangs in Garden City, How Immigration, Segregation, and Youth Violence Are Changing America's Suburbs. Well, we heard what the FBI had to say. What is your assessment on how effective this FBI approach is being in addressing the problems of MS-13? Samuel?
Well, I would say in certain cities, you know, in the tri-state area here around D.C. and over in Nashville, down in Charlotte, over in L.A., I think it's been very effective. As Mr. Brown noted, or Special Agent Brown noted, the use of the task forces, I think, has been very effective. And then on the prosecuting end, the use of the RICO Act, the Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, to essentially link a bunch of members together for coming together to plan crime. That's been very successful in terms of bringing them together and prosecuting them all together. However, I think at a national level, in terms of trying to take down the whole gang across the 42 states or perhaps all 50 states, there's still a challenge. And I think the challenge is largely due to communication and just a lack of information that's moving around.
Sarah, what's your perspective on how effective law enforcement is being in addressing this problem?
I actually disagree that the efforts have been all that effective. Obviously, over the past 10 years, you've seen the gang spread further. And part of the reason for that is because I think that the tactic has been to treat these gangs as if they are highly organized, highly sophisticated, as if they are like the mafia, and on the ground, and you know, there may, you know, I don't disagree that there may be some links between leadership in cliques in El Salvador and leadership in other cities in the United States, but on the ground, you know, talking to gang members who are in Long Island, and also I spent time talking with MS-13 members in El Salvador in prisons there, you really don't find that that connection or that, and also that level of sophistication. I mean, you have a lot of these murders have been very terrible, but you don't, you know, see kids using knives, attacking each other with Snapple bottles. And so, you know, and I think that the local police in a lot of places have also come to that same assessment. In Long Island, I was speaking with a gang unit detective yesterday who was saying, you know, here the gang members really don't have a connection with kids in Virginia or kids in El Salvador, except to maybe they have a cousin in Virginia that they talk to who's a part of the gang, but they're not sending each other orders, they're not taking orders. They're much more of a homegrown phenomenon.
What do you think about that, Samuel? Do you think this is a kind of a less sophisticated collection of people than maybe we think of when we think of an organized gang?
Well, listening right now, I had two thoughts. The first would be that in my research, I found most often that the guys who were on the ground, the gang detectives, they were saying that less than 4 out of 10 are actually very active, hardcore, violent, sociopathic individuals. The rest are kids who, for one reason or another, decided to join the gang, and maybe we'll get into that. And they found themselves in over their head, and now they're scared and they're trying to survive. I believe that's absolutely true.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the individual stories that our two journalists found of people who had gotten into the gangs, why they joined, maybe the trouble they had getting out. Our phone lines are now open. You can call 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking with two journalists who have written books that talk about the MS-13, the Hispanic street gang that's been found now in 42 states in the District of Columbia. Sarah Garland is with us, and also Samuel Logan. Let's take a step back and talk about what MS-13 means. Samuel, what does it mean?
Well, MS-13, taken at face value, I think people that are just beginning to learn about MS-13, to them it means a very violent street gang.
But I mean, actually, what does MS stand for the number 13?
So the MS stands for the Mara Salvatrucha. Mara, the word Mara in itself, within the El Salvadorian Spanish, simply means a group or a clique. Salvatrucha, as I'm sure Sarah has found, has many, many different meanings, depends on who you ask or what you read. But I decided to translate it as essentially streetwise. So you have a streetwise group, but that's the Mara Salvatrucha. And over time, unfortunately, the word Mara alone has evolved into a meaning that is now gang. Whereas if you talk to Salvadorians, they'll tell you, no, it just means group.
And what does the 13 stand for?
Well, the 13 was picked up by the members of the Mara Salvatrucha as the gang was evolving in Los Angeles, I believe in the early 90s, when they came into contact with the Mexican Mafia, which is a prison gang in Southern California, or that was started there. And once they worked out an allegiance with the Mexican Mafia, which is also known as La M, the M in Spanish, they picked up the 13 because that's the number of the letter M in the alphabet.
And I'm wondering how difficult it was for each of you to do research to get gang members to talk to you, to find out about what their lives were like. Sarah, tell us.
It took a long time to get, I spent basically 5 years with three gang members, getting to know them very well. And at first it took some time to get to know them and to get them to trust me. But, you know, particularly, you know, for example, with Danielle, he was a 14-year-old when I met him. I met him at school. He had just come from El Salvador a couple of years earlier. His mom had sent for him. He had been living in El Salvador with an aunt for 9 years, hadn't seen her. And then when he moved to the United States, made a friend in school, was having a hard time. And his friend was murdered. And so he was dealing with that. So when I met him, he was having trouble at home. He was dealing with the murder of his friend. And nobody had really ever talked to him before about what his life had been like in Long Island, where he was living. And so, you know, after an initial, you know, difficulty getting him to talk to me, he opened up and it was much easier. And I think it was a situation where, you know, just no one had ever asked for him to tell his story.
And how about you, Samuel? How did you get gang members to open up to you so you could get information about him?
Well, I agree with Sarah. It's a difficult process. Fortunately, I've been speaking Spanish for a long time, so that was a helpful tool. And so when I contacted, when I tried to reach out to gang members, the initial contact was always in Spanish. And then it's also, you know, I interviewed gang members in prison, and so that was the bureaucracy there was very heavy, and that took a while to get through. I'll also say, though, that, you know, when you finally get to the phone number of a gang member or a former gang member, you're thinking, this guy will never talk to me. Then you call him and, you know, what you can find out is that it's surprising that they actually are interested in telling you their story.
Well, what did they think about you all writing books about their gang? What did they think that was? Did they think that was a great thing, or were they suspicious?
There was some hesitation, I think, in terms of safety issues, but I think also street gangs are very much about, you know, they care a lot about publicity. They want people to know about them. They want people to think they're the toughest gang out there. I think that's one of the issues with MS-13 is that they've been publicized as the most ruthless gang, the most dangerous gang in the United States, and they love that. You know, that's exactly what gangs are hoping for. So really, you know, fundamentally, it's not that difficult. I spoke with the leader of 18th Street in El Salvador at one point, and he was happy to talk to me because he wants people to know about his gang.
They're known as a violent gang. Did you either ever feel unsafe or in danger?
Well, when I went to prison to interview one of the characters in my book, Vito, there was about a 2.5-hour interview that I had with him, and he was on the other side of the glass there. But he's an active gang member, and he still holds a position of rank, so I was a little, you know, apprehensive going into that. And the first 10 minutes of the interview was a little, you know, given me that look with his eyes, like, you know, I can break you or whatever. But once we got past that, he opened up and he was a regular guy, although he had MS-13 tattooed on his forehead.
Now, what are the tell us about the tattoos, Sarah, that many MS-13 members get?
Well, it's one of the differences you'll see between MS-13 members in different regions and in El Salvador. So in Long Island, or, you know, in even in other southern cities or Los Angeles, it's much rarer to find an MS-13 member with an MS across their face and visible, you know, above their neck. When I was in El Salvador talking to kids in jail, you know, I talked to one 18-year-old boy who was in for committing murder, and his face was completely covered in tattoos, so much so that it was the ink that they used was green, so you could see it was more green than it was skin colored. So,
Now, Sam, your book focuses on Brenda Paz. Mm-hmm. Who was she?
Well, Brenda Paz was born in Honduras. She legally immigrated to the U.S. when she was 3, and was a very happy and well loved young girl until she was 15, when, through a twist of fate, she moved to Texas to live with an uncle, and. Because she was very charismatic and extroverted, she was needy for attention, got her energy from being around people, and just didn't receive that at her uncle's home in Carrollton. So Brenda sought that elsewhere, and she ran into the guy that I mentioned before, Vito, who happened to be the leader of the local clique, MS-13 clique in Carrollton. And he gave her everything she needed. She fell in love with him. And he persuaded her to join the gang. So Brenda, in a very short amount of time, went from being a very popular kid at school, very good in the classroom, very well loved, to being the sitting next to one of the craziest MS-13 guys in Texas.
And what is the process of joining the gang, Sarah? What do you have to do?
Most. For boys and also for some girls, you have to be beaten up. So it depends on the gang.
Beaten up by whom?
By your fellow gang members. So they'll bring you, into a secluded area. Most of the kids that I talked to had been jumped in the woods around the high school. And they'll put you in a circle and count a certain number of seconds. With MS-13, it's 13 seconds. With other gangs, 18th Street, it might be 15 or 18 seconds. It sort of depends. And they'll kick and hit and beat you for that amount of time. And after that's over, you're basically in. And there's some other rituals. Most gangs have a prayer, and you need to memorize the prayer and be able to say it, because they say it at every meeting. But that's basically it.
And jumped in is what you said. That's how most boys become members. How about girls?
There is, I've heard that girls, they call it being sexton, and they're basically gang raped. I think, I'm not sure how prevalent that is. And girls don't have the same status usually in the gang that boys do. But you also have girls who will just sort of hang around the gang and be girlfriends, and they may not actually be official members.
And Brenda, how did she join?
She was jumped in.
So she was beaten up. She let herself be beaten up to join the gang. Now, what happened? What happened with her situation then?
Well, Brenda was jumped in, and I think she chose to do so for two reasons. I think as part of her personality, she was very strong-willed and had a strong personality. But also because she was dating the leader of that clique that was jumping her in, that was a matter, it was a matter of pride for him. What happened after that for her, it was within a matter of weeks that she watched her boyfriend kill a friend of hers. And she would have participated in the gang beating of him before this guy was killed. But she was still too sore from her jumping in. So she stayed in the car and just simply watched. And no one knew until Vito pulled a pistol on this guy that he was actually going to be shot in the head. And Brenda's history in the gang moved forward, by Vito's side, seeing all sorts of horrible things and riding with him to dump bodies and other sorts of things that she later disclosed when she became an informant.
She became an informant for?
Well, initially she was an informant for the Fairfax County Police Department through Sergeant Mike Porter, who's also in my book. And over time, she decided to disclose much more information and essentially became an informant for really any gang detective or detective, homicide detective, who was willing to abide by her legal guardian's rules and Mike Porter's rules in terms of prosecution. And so they would fly in and talk with her. And she actually helped him close some cases.
But eventually, she joined the Witness Protection Program.
She did.
What happened to her then?
Well, she joined the Witness Protection Program and initially went to Philadelphia, where they cleanse her past. She was then taken to Kansas City, and the interesting thing about Brenda's case was that normally when people enter Witness Protection, they are mob informants, so they're middle-aged men who are joining the program to protect themselves but also their family. Brenda went in without any parental supervision. She was essentially handed off to the federal marshals who were supposed to take care of her in Kansas City. And again, Brenda was needy, extroverted, and she just wasn't, I guess psychologically or mentally in a position to put up with that. She needed more than they were willing to give her.
And so then what happened?
Well, so she saw an MS-13 member in Kansas City, and that's sort of a red flag. So they had to move her, and they moved her to Minnesota, cold. She was alone. She was in a hotel room. At the time, she was also pregnant. So a lot of things are coming together for her. And she's also having a struggle with her identity because they had given her a new identity and she didn't know how to deal with that. And so she decided to reach out to the only people that she thought she could. And that was, it happened to be a guy named Dennis who was her boyfriend at the time and also a fairly highly ranked member of the MS-13.
And then?
Then she, over a period of time, she was talking to Dennis and invited more people up from the MS-13. They drove 14 hours from Virginia to her hotel room in Minnesota and stayed there and partied with her for a while. At that point, because they partied so much, the hotel kicked them out. And she decided to ride with them back to Virginia and to come back to the MS-13, hoping that her lies and her guile and her wit would be able to cover up what she had done, her betrayal. Essentially, her motivation was to get back to the father of her child.
And that didn't work out for her.
No, it didn't. A very close friend of hers within the gang who had been talking to her about taking her to his favorite fishing hole made the invitation, along with a guy she was dating at the time and another individual. And so they drove to the Shenandoah River Valley, where the fishing hole allegedly was, and that's where they killed her.
Mm. Sarah, you write about the incursions of MS-13, even in places like Long Island, which we do not think of as a hotbed of gang activity. What's happening in some of these, some of these suburbs?
Well, I was surprised when I first went out to Long Island for the first time. You know, you picture the Long Island suburbs as, you know, Levittown, and then, you know, places like Garden City, which is right next to the town that I focused on, where the lawns are big, the houses are big, the yards are green and well mowed. And in Hempstead, it's very different. It's an older suburb. Most of the white middle class has moved out, and it's now an extremely segregated pocket where there's a lot of poverty, and where a new wave of Hispanic immigrants has moved in because they're, especially during the 90s, there was a lot of work to do in Long Island. And I think you've seen this around the country where the number of Hispanic immigrants moving to suburbs, you know, suddenly they're skipping the cities and moving straight to the suburbs because that's where the jobs are. But when they get there, they often find that they're very isolated. In a lot of places, there's been a backlash. They're not welcome there necessarily. Some people have resented their arrival, been worried they were taking jobs, been fearful that they were, you know, they would bring a criminal element. And so they found themselves, you know, sort of alienated and struggling to get by. And you know, it's very difficult. I think it's one of the things that's facilitated these gangs. One of the examples that always struck me is really, you know, it was one of the women I interviewed. She had always growing up had been, she was American born. She was living in Long Island, but she carried around her passport because she was worried that if she was ever picked up by police, they wouldn't believe her that she was an American citizen. And so, you know, even though she was American, she'd grown up, she spoke English better than she spoke Spanish, because her parents were Honduran, she felt like an outsider, like she didn't belong. And so to me, it wasn't surprising that she eventually ended up in a gang.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to go to the phones now, 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Rochelle, Illinois, and Lisa's on the phone. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you today?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The main reason I called is because I've heard none of your guests mention my area, and we have an exploding gang population here of all kinds. A couple years ago, we started noticing the MS-13 graffiti. We have Latin Kings here. We have motorcycle gangs here. We got Hell's Angels. We got Brothers. We got black population moving out to the city for housing because Mayor Daley has gotten rid of a lot of the low-income housing.
How big is your town?
We live in a town below 10,000. I live about 80 miles west of Chicago. We have two interstate highways. We have two rail lines. We have a large migrant and immigrant population because we have meat processing plants. We have an agriculture here, so we have migrant workers. We have, you know, kids coming in and out of the school system. As I said, my main concern was I never heard you mention the Midwest or the Chicago area, and it's getting really tense here.
And Lisa, just tell us briefly, what's been the impact on your town to have these gangs there?
Well, as I said, there's been graffiti. There's been a lot of drug traffic increase in the bars. We actually have Latin Kings that pretty much own a bar in town. We have a lot of, as they talked about, young people fights breaking out in schools. My daughter just graduated from the local high school, and she more than once had to get out of the way of some pretty violent altercations, whether they were gang-related or not. You can't say for sure in the school because they have to dress, you know, they can't dress in the way that would indicate who they belong to, correct? But I have a 9-year-old son. we have a 2-acre patch of woods that separates us from a trailer park where there's a very large immigrant population, and we were just inundated with graffiti recently, you know, the fences, the sheds, and it's kind of scary. I guess my question would be, as a citizen, number one, I'd like to point out to the FBI and whoever's listening, please come to Rochelle, Illinois. And as I said, I have a 10-year-old son in the school system, and anything I do as a citizen to try and address this, I don't want repercussions to come back on him.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. It sounds like a very difficult situation. What about the Middle West? Has that become a real hotbed for gangs, MS-13 and otherwise?
I definitely, you know, it has, and I think Agent Brown mentioned Omaha and Denver, and I was actually just recently in Omaha and talking to people there about the school system, and you have a very divided, you know, you've had a lot of tensions between groups, between white and African American, but also with a new Hispanic population that's moving in, that are low income and that need a lot of services, and they're trying to figure out how to deal with that.
Sarah Garland, her new book is called Gangs in Garden City. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll go back to the phones. We'll take your calls and read your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Robin and Murray Sinclair, helping sustain NPR's coverage of the global economy. By the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, informing health reform with policy research, data, and expert commentary. On the web at healthreform.org. And by the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide. On the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a new documentary about a cove in Japan where dolphins are captured and sold to aquariums around the world and the remaining dolphins are slaughtered. We'll talk with filmmaker Luis Sahoyas and Rick O'Barry, who trained the dolphins that played Flipper and is now obsessed with rescuing dolphins. Also, we talk with actor Eric Bana. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking this hour about the problems of MS-13, the violent Hispanic street gang, and we're talking with two journalists who have written books on the subject, Samuel Logan and Sarah Garland. You know, these gangs are built on with immigrants, but of course, Samuel, most immigrants are not members of the gangs. And including most immigrants from places like El Salvador, that's very tied with MS-13. Put that in some perspective for us.
Well, I think when we talk about how gangs like the MS-13 are you know, maybe quote unquote hiding in plain sight inside these immigrant communities, and they thrive upon them, they can find sanctuary within them. It's important to note, I think, at least two points. And the first is most immigrants are hardworking individuals who don't want to get into any trouble. Want to keep their head low and just work hard, and do well by their family and their friends. And the second point I think that's important to make is that most Latino youths are not gang members. When you think about the millions of Latinos that live in this country, and a gang like the Mara Salvatrucha has maybe at least 10,000 members across the country, it gives you an idea of what we're looking at.
What do you think, Sarah?
Well, and I think just to add on to that point, it's also important to point out that even within the gangs, that the kids who are acting violently and are committing the most, you know, the heinous crimes that you hear about are also a very small minority. So you have kids who have different relationships to the gangs. They may hang out on the periphery and may not be that involved. You have wannabes and so on. But it's very true. Most of the kids that I interviewed, and I spent a lot of time talking to kids of, you know, all backgrounds in Hempstead High School, and the percentage that were actually in a gang was very small, even though a lot of them had gone through a lot of difficulties.
And what kids are most likely to join a gang? What are the elements that seem common with the gang members?
Well, a dysfunctional family situation due to immigration and deportation in those cycles, that often affects these families. You have a kid who, as Sarah mentioned earlier, one of the characters in her book, he was brought to the United States after having lived 9 years in El Salvador with an aunt.
That's right.
One of the characters in my book had lived for most of his young life in El Salvador with his grandmother. So at least in the case of one of my characters, he was brought to the U.S. He arrived here, didn't speak much English or very little, and had two younger brothers who were born here while he was in El Salvador. So suddenly he's meeting strangers who are calling his mother mom, and that can be frustrating. He's held back in school. That's frustrating. The culture shock, and it all comes together for a pre-adolescent or an adolescent, and a lot of frustration is built up. You combine that with no after-school activity. Parents aren't really cognizant of what's going on because they may be working two jobs apiece. They're not home when the kid comes home from school. So where does he or she go? They go to the street or to a local park. And you have the fact that in some areas, MS-13 is so present that they're waiting right there at the border of the school in the parking lot, ready and willing to recruit.
And Sarah, what kind of techniques do they use for recruitment?
Well, you know, I was actually also talking with police about this, about the issue of recruitment. And I think actually Brenda Pazzi quotes her in the book talking about how kids actually recruit themselves to the gang. And none of the kids that I met who had joined a gang had met with, you know, a recruiter in the sense that you have an army recruiter going to a high school and like setting up a booth and talking to kids. And I think that that's the picture that often is portrayed. You know, politicians have passed a lot of laws or brought up a lot of bills where they were going to ban gang recruitment on high school grounds. And it sounds good, but I don't think it actually happens in that way. I think it's a much more natural process where kids join a gang if their friends are a part of a gang or if the older kids in their school are members and it's the cool thing to do. And if you're going to a school where it's, you know, very high poverty, very isolated, then often the gangs are the cool kids.
Well, you also write about using soccer games and barbecues as a technique to draw kids toward the gang.
Well, it's, you know, in a place like Hempstead, this, you know, after school, all of the kids, you know, walk along the street and they go to the middle school and they're hanging out in the McDonald's and there's this mixture. And for the young kids, especially, you know, the kids we're talking about who come from El Salvador, whose parents have sent for them because they couldn't afford to bring them at the same time that they came. They're coming. They don't know anyone. They're often, you know, being beaten up by bullies when they first arrive. They're not getting along very well with their families necessarily. So they gravitate to the kids who will take care of them and who offer that protection.
Well, of course, we want law enforcement against the crimes that are committed. But I wonder if some communities tried to really step up after school, more legitimate after school programs in an effort to make it harder to recruit for a gang?
Well, I was going to say soccer can be used to recruit, but it can also be used to prevent. In Arlington County, Robert Vilches, who does gang prevention there, has operated a very successful soccer program. Where kids can go after school and they're part of a team. They have a sense of competition. They want to practice. And they also find dignity in something as simple as scoring a goal, as opposed to being jumped into a gang and going out and beating someone up. So there are many, many strategies out there for prevention, and after school programs is certainly one of them.
Are there any big success stories when it comes to trying to combat gangs? Any community that's had remarkable success? Or is everybody kind of struggling?
You know, there's people often talk about Boston, and it's not necessarily related to the MS-13 program, but they had a program that police talk about a lot. And a lot of police chiefs that I've spoken with about this issue have said, you know what, law enforcement isn't the answer. We can't do this. We can't. And I think the FBI director earlier pointed out that we can't arrest away this problem. And so, you know, Boston had a program where they were really tough on the gangs, but at the same time, they had job programs and alternatives that they were offering. In a place like Hempstead, you have an organization called Strong Youth that's run by a former gang member who's trying to get gang members to leave and trying to offer, you know, connections to jobs and so on. And he works closely with the police, and they do presentations in schools. So I think you have there's a lot of police out there saying, you know, arrest, we need more money for schools and for prevention programs, not for police.
And Samuel, you also found, though, that there were communities that wanted to deny that gangs were a problem at all.
Yeah, well, I some of the at the county council level, the local leaders, local community leaders, some of them with whom I've interviewed or spoken with, in different states across the country, they're reluctant to admit that there's a gang problem. They're worried about tax base, and it's a political thing. And sometimes you get into a situation where there's patrolmen, there's cops who are working a beat in a certain community, and they're looking at it, and they ask their sheriff or their sergeant or whoever to try and liaise with the county council, and there's resistance there. But we're seeing, you know, in this area, like in Montgomery County or in Arlington County, Fairfax, Loudoun County, where once the community leaders have decided to say, okay, we have a gang problem and we're going to go after it, that's usually the first step towards a sustainable solution.
All right, let's talk to Mike. He's calling us from Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I wanted to mention, I used to live in a part of Falls Church that is a heavily immigrant community and has a fair amount of MS penetration, and I would run into this when, you know, I'd be on the basketball courts and some of these kids would come and they're, you know, well, they want to play basketball, but they're bandaged up or they're bloody. They've had a lot of things that's gone wrong with them, but to me, they look like little kids. They're like 12, 13, 14 years old, and I can't tell whether they are MS or whether they just want to be MS. So what is that? What is the gang's position, feeling on people who claim to be MS who maybe really aren't?
All right, Mike, thanks very much for your call.
Well, in my research, I came across a case in Northern Virginia where one kid who was throwing up MS-13 hand signs and trying to stack, trying to basically fake it in front of a couple of other MS-13 members, he was actually killed. Later on down the road, that was a very serious incident.
Because he was pretending to
pretending to be MS-13.
What are the hand signs for MS-13?
Well, the most common one would be something akin to what many of us have seen on Beavis and Butthead, where they basically with the pointer finger and the pinky finger make the horns.
Hard to show on radio, but
right.
Yeah.
Well, here in the studio, we can all see it. But it's, you know, at UT Texas, they call it hook 'em horns. It's the same thing. Sometimes they hold it front ways or sometimes back ways. So,
Sarah, you mentioned also about a prayer that is sometimes used in the ceremony for initiation. We have a tweet from Kevin saying, what is the prayer you're talking about?
Oh, well, it's a long prayer. I don't have it memorized, but it's a rhyming. It's a rhyming set of verses that basically gets to the point of, you know, I'm sorry for the sins I've committed. I'm sorry for upsetting my family and hurting my mother. I probably won't live another day. Is the gist. But it's quite depressing. But they also say it before every meeting, and I think it breeds cohesion within the gang.
And do they memorize it, or are they reading it off something?
They memorize it, and Danielle has had a copy that he kept in his wallet. He had left the gang at some point. He was around 18, but he still kept this piece of paper with the gang's prayer. It was, you know, sort of worn almost tissue thin, kept it with him at all times.
Let's go to the phones to Greensboro, North Carolina, and talk to Don. Don, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks very much. I want to add a little bit to this, if I can, which may be in conflict with what I'm hearing. Having served as a consular officer in the U.S. Embassy in San Salvador in 1988 to 1992, I had, unfortunately, very, very close and intimate contact with these guys as they were deported from the United States. It was my unpleasant duty to meet them at the airport and kind of ensure that certain members of the Salvadoran military and police did not execute them on their way from the airport back to San Salvador. I did not succeed at this.
I want to make sure I understand this. So these people were being deported from the United States.
Yeah, this was in the early days of this. I don't think many Americans were even aware of the Marisol Trucha at all. And incidentally, my knowledge of Salvadoran Spanish, the word mara means exactly the way what we know it to mean. It doesn't mean group or anything benevolent or benign at all. It means a criminal gang, and that's the way they use it. But in any case, these gangs were existing in El Salvador before they began came into existence in the United States. And the planes would come in with INS officers on them, big, you know, multi-jets full of these guys. And I have to tell you that I was in Vietnam for 2 years, and I've seen poverty, and I've seen violence, and I have never seen such degraded specimens of humanity as these guys getting off these planes. And I have to admit that the Salvadorans that I know, the decent, law-abiding Salvadorans, of whom there are many, felt exactly the same way, the same revulsion toward these people that I did. I also had the unpleasant duty of visiting Americans who were incarcerated there, and I saw the Mara Salvatrucha members in prison, which was also an unpleasant. I can say nothing that would whitewash these guys or their identity. To me, just their very presence in this country indicates that we really need to look at our immigration policies. Having them here in the United States and having some kind of a benign, they're just misguided kids attitude toward them, it's like volunteering for cancer and then refusing to cure it. I think we're really on the wrong path with these people.
Well, and yeah. Don, I also on the first thing you said, so you would escort these people who'd been deported to San Salvador, and then would they be set free or go to prison or what?
Yeah, no. The ones who were deported from the United States had committed no offense in El Salvador. But the Salvador, you may have heard of the so-called death squads and so on that existed during that. This was during and just at the end of the insurgency in El Salvador, and. I death squads may be an exaggeration, but the attitude of the Salvadoran police, the three different law enforcement organizations that existed in El Salvador at that time, was to basically shoot these guys on sight. And frequently, the airport in that serves San Salvador is about 35 kilometers away from the city. It's on the coast. And you have to take a long ride back into the city through desolate, semi-mountainous, arid terrain to get to the city of San Salvador. And what we had heard at the embassy was that these guys were arriving and then never making it to San Salvador. And the embassy decided that, in cooperation with the UN, that we needed to look at this and have a presence at the airport. And this fell to me. Somebody up there loves me. And so this was one of the things that I did. And every week I met the incoming deportation flight, linked up with the INS agents, usually brought them in and, you know, took them out for dinner and sent them out the next morning. But it was impossible to follow these guys once they were released. But the police, Salvadoran police units in plain clothes, were clearly evident outside the airport in parked vans. And when these guys were released from the airport, they arranged whatever transportation they could and headed back to San Salvador. Now, I can't tell you the percentage that made or didn't make. Yeah. I would have no feeling
right
on that.
Uh-huh. Oh, Don, that is so interesting. Thank you so much for calling and sharing your perspective on this. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now, both of you have spent time in San Salvador. You've probably been to that very airport. What do you think about what we heard from Don?
Well, you know, he's talking about a period, and I think he's talking about the first generation of MS-13, and it's very true that immigration policy had a lot to do with the spread of the gang, and it was in 96 that a new policy was put in place to deport criminal immigrants. So if you'd committed a crime, a felony, then you were deported, and this led to this huge influx of gang members back to El Salvador. You had tens of thousands. They rivaled the police force back in El Salvador. And they got there. A lot of them were refugees from the Civil War. They'd fought either on the government side or on the rebel side. They had fled to Los Angeles to get away from the violence. Most of them were not given refugee status. And so they were living sort of in marginal neighborhoods, scraping to get by, doing day labor and so on. A lot of them were brought into the gangs. Not all of them, but, you know, a few of them were brought into the gangs. And then they were sent back. And El Salvador couldn't handle it. And there was also an economic crisis going on in El Salvador. So there was nothing for them to do. You had a heavy government crackdown against them, like he mentioned, the paramilitary going after them. So it was a place they wanted to get out of as soon as possible. So you had some of those come back to the United States, move to different cities. But you also had families in El Salvador who were trying to get away from the war, and they were spreading out to new places across the United States, to the D.C. area, to Long Island. I think what we're dealing with now, we have some of those older gang members who are still around, but you also have a new generation, and those are the kids, the 12-year-olds and 13-year-olds that the earlier caller talked about seeing on the basketball court. And they weren't involved in the war. They're obviously too young. And they're a new generation who have heard of MS-13, and when they get here, you know, it's the scary gang that they've all heard of and that they want to join.
Sarah Garland, she's the author of Gangs in Garden City, and we've also been joined this hour by Samuel Logan. He's the author of This Is for the Mara Salvatrucha, Inside the MS-13. I want to thank both of you for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Andrew Chadwick. Dori Anisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.